So tonight is the second class in our series about on Thich Nhat Hanh's book No Death, No Fear. Tonight is on chapter 3 and 4, the practice of looking deeply and transforming grief and fear. I have things to point out and present, but like we did last week, I thought we might want to take 10 minutes or so for people to share. If you have a passage, a sentence, or a short passage from this section that really struck you, and maybe you can also even share why in particular that really resonated with you, or what it made you think about. If you have something even from the first 4 chapters so far that you would like to share, please go ahead and unmute yourself and do so.
Okay, I'll just read one sentence that I liked. But without an awakened understanding of impermanence, it is not possible to be happy. Mm. That just sort of struck me that things could be bad, but it's not permanent.
Mm. That was the same one I was going to do, so I'll be quiet.
What are the chances of that?
Yeah.
There's a nice short one that struck me. And that was the philosophers have said that you can never bathe twice in the same river. Mm-hmm. I think that's a nice, succinct way of reminding us the importance of mindfulness.
Thank you.
One thing that caught my attention, I always struggle with the term emptiness. And on the first part of chapter 2, he says, emptiness is just means the exist. I'm gonna screw it up. But emptiness just means the extinction of ideas. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, that is a definition of emptiness that I can really understand. I appreciate Thich Nhat Hanh's simplicity so much.
This one is more about happiness. It says, please remember that your notions of happiness may be very dangerous. Mm. The Buddha said happiness can only be possible in the here and now. So go back and examine deeply your notions and ideas of happiness. You may recognize that the conditions of happiness that are already there in your life are enough. Then happiness can be instantly yours.
Somehow he manages to be so affirming and positive without being I don't know, pandering or kind of overly simplistic, or I don't know what. So this, the first thing that I'm going to quote from Thich Nhat Hanh is actually from chapter one, right at the very beginning. But as you probably noticed, there are many themes from the first two chapters that continue to weave their way through the third and fourth. So he says, our greatest fear is that when we die, we will become nothing. Many of us believe that our entire existence is only a life space beginning the moment we are born or conceived and ending the moment we die. We believe we are born from nothing and that when we die, we become nothing. And so we are feared with the fear of annihilation. And he lists eight concepts that fuel our fear. Let's see. So there are eight basic concepts that serve to fuel our fear. They are the notions of birth and death, coming and going, same and different, being and non-being. These notions keep us from being happy. The teaching given to counteract these notions are called the eight no's, which are no birth, no death, no coming, no going, not the same, not different, no being, no non-being. So repeatedly, he talks about how the teachings and concepts are tools. It says the practice and understanding of impermanence, for example, is not just another description of reality. It is a tool that helps us in our transformation, healing, and emancipation. So kind of to get at what a couple people have already read, I love this. This is a section that's labeled Nirvana. Impermanence and no self are not rules to follow given us by the Buddha. They are keys to open the door of reality. The idea of permanence is wrong, so the teaching of impermanence helps us correct our view of permanence. If we get caught in the idea of impermanence, we have not realized nirvana. The idea of self is wrong, so we use the idea of non-self to cure it. If we get caught in the idea of non-self, then that is not good for us either. Impermanence and no self are keys to the practice. They are not absolute truths. We do not die for them or kill for them. So, I like this, impermanence and no self are not rules. They're just keys to correcting our opposite ideas. So, numerous times, Thich Nhat Hanh brings up the metaphor of the cloud. So, that things manifest when the conditions are right. So, vapor comes up and it forms in the air and it forms a cloud. And then the cloud changes shape, and then eventually, it's, you know, something happens and that turns into rain, and then the cloud is gone. So it's just a manifestation. Nothing has been lost. It's not like, when was the cloud born? When did the cloud die? It just you know, this manifestation came and went. So he says when the cloud, but he talks about, you know, either us getting attached to the cloud, you know, kind of a parable, or the cloud itself having a sense of self. But when the cloud, he said, when the cloud is not caught by the idea of birth or death, or being or non-being, there is no fear. By learning from the cloud, we can nurture our non-fear. Non-fear is the ground of our true well-being. As long as there is fear in us, happiness cannot be perfect. So I wanted to explore a little bit about self. Because what we're talking about is our concern about the what happens to the self. So the self when we die, or the self when certain changes happen, this kind of fear of annihilation. And honestly, this is something that for many of us, you know, there may be certain times when we lose someone, or we're afraid of losing someone, or we're facing death or severe illness or something like that, that this may come up very obviously, that we are, that this is a big concern. Most of the time, it's more subtle than that. Most of the time, it is, even though he says, as long as there is fear in us, our happiness cannot be perfect. But it's a fear that we don't necessarily recognize where it is coming from. We don't recognize that our agitation, or our desire to control things, or our, you know, fear of intimacy, or various things like that, are actually tied up in this concern for self and self-preservation. So I want to explore our preoccupation with self. And of course, it's not just about ourselves either. We, you know, we're concerned about the self nature of other people in our lives, our loved ones, you know, about the continuation and existence of their self. And what is it we're really concerned about? So I wanted to kind of deconstruct the concept or experience of self, not in order to get abstract or intellectual about it, but just to get us thinking, to get the juices flowing, to maybe cause questions to arise. So I was looking up definitions of self, and there's quite a few of them. There's dictionary definitions, there's definitions in psychology, but it seemed to me that there were, I don't know, I might think about it differently tomorrow, but like four categories, four types of experiences that we're talking about when we use the word self. So the first, if you will, is the most obvious, or maybe the most, I don't know about shallow, but is our conventional self. So the observable aspects of our manifestation that are clearly ours and characterize us as an individual. Our body, sensations, perceptions, emotions, thoughts, interests, opinions, motivations, personality, tendencies, habits. You know, so this is like the Buddhist, you know, five aggregates. We're a collection of stuff. And, you know, there's a collection of stuff that's Domio, and there's a collection of stuff that's Bob, and a collection of stuff that's Joan. And we understand that each of us has different flavor, different tendencies, different responsibilities, different relationships and roles and all that. Persona, identity, that kind of thing. So we may be very, of course, we are very interested in and obsessed with and absorbed with this aspect of ourselves. But I think especially when we start to practice, this is perhaps the easiest aspect of self to kind of see through, to recognize in which way it is impermanent, that it is kind of arbitrary, that being overly attached to it is not all that helpful. So those kinds of aspects of ourselves tend to be the first that we really start questioning a relationship with. Like, you know, we're not so starting to let go of the narratives about our personality or our lives or who we are, that kind of thing. So there's that conventional aspect of self, which is the whole collection of things that are identified as ours. Now, the second aspect is individuality or difference. So this is where, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh was pointing out, this is one of our obsessions, right? Same or different. And we are, so these are the aspects of ourselves which are different or separate from others. Obviously, our body is separate. I mean, this is kind of the whole definition of being an individual. Our perceptions are different. No one else can see things or experiencing things through our own body and mind. You see kids start to individuate very, very quickly. You know, at some point they go like, oh, I like this and I don't like that. And this is my opinion. And I'm so like, they're defining self by defining difference. So these are the things that, I mean, obviously this is overlap with that first category, but at a real fundamental level, especially at that level of perception and sensation, you know, there's this experience of being an individual, being a being that no one else has. So we are different from, separate from. So this aspect is very, this is much more difficult to see as empty. It's much more difficult to see this as a manifestation because it seems so self-evident. It seems so fundamental. We are separate. We are not, I am not Jill. I am not Mark. Like, what are you talking about? Like, there's a separation. There's a difference there. But the teachings are telling us that this is not, this too is a manifestation. This too is empty. So the third aspect of self, that as I was thinking about it, is our sense of agency, our sense of, you know, we are in control of this being. Sometimes we have to admit we're not totally in control. Like when we sit zazen and we can't stop our mind from wandering, we go, it doesn't look like I'm entirely in control here. But for the most part, we maintain that sense of, you know, I decide what I'm going to do, what I'm going to say, choices I'm going to make. I decide my behavior. And that is something that is even more difficult for us to let go of or see through. But I, you know, keep mentioning the wonderful teaching from the book, Why Buddhism is True, by the evolutionary psychologist, and the studies that he's cited about how we, you know, our brain doesn't work the way we think it does. And that the narrative, the conscious narrative that explains, you know, well, we're doing this because of that, and then we made this choice, and then we did this. They've shown in experimental situations that much of the time, that is really just an after-the-fact explanation of what happened, and that we weren't even really aware of what motivated us, and we're just coming up with a story to explain what happened. So that is very, causes some questioning of this sense of agency, and really, anyone who struggled with addictions, anyone who struggled with bad habits, always also knows that, you know, the whole way we work is not that simple. It's not just a matter of there being a being inside who's in control of everything. So that is something that's very difficult to to let go of, you know, even in our meditation, and we're being asked to settle deeply and not try to control our experience or something, but there's still an I who is meditating, right? There's still an I who is trying to relax. There's still an I who would like to be calm. There's still this sense of I. And so related to that, the fourth aspect is our, I guess, the object of our self-consciousness or awareness. So I found this very helpful, a definition. The self, this is getting more into the psychological definitions. The self is an individual person as the object of its own reflective consciousness. So this is from a Stanford University site. Self-consciousness can be understood as an awareness of oneself. But a self-conscious subject is not just aware of something that merely happens to be themselves, as one is if one sees an old photograph without realizing that it is of oneself. Rather, a self-conscious subject is aware of themselves as themselves. It is manifest to them that they themselves are the object of awareness. Self-consciousness is a form of consciousness that is paradigmatically expressed in English by the words I, me, and my, terms that each of us uses to refer to ourselves as such. So in a sense, you can, there's like this double layer, this meta layer of consciousness. So, you know, to some extent, probably animals are self-conscious, you know, like that's my foot. And, you know, some can recognize themselves in mirrors and stuff. But we are conscious of ourselves and, if you will, conscious of being conscious of ourselves. So if you think about it, even like the kind of personal identity aspect of ourselves, we can see become altered or changed, for instance, in something like Alzheimer's, and, you know, memories and various things like that can change. But I think most of us would say that there's still, you know, a lot has changed, but there's still some fundamental thing there. There's still this self-consciousness is still present. So obviously, you know, that's a very complicated topic that I'm no expert in. But the point is that we might be a little bit okay with losing that first aspect of our characteristics. You know, whatever. I mean, we've changed a lot over the course of our lives, and we understand that, you know, that isn't that important in a way to our sense of self. And maybe even we can conceive of giving up some of that individuality, of that difference. Maybe there's a sense, you know, we've tasted some transcendence or some sense of connection or non-separation and that kind of thing, that, you know, maybe there we can kind of imagine that sense of individuality is just a manifestation. Once we get to agency and self-consciousness, that is a lot harder to see as just a manifestation. I don't know about you, but when I think of Thich Nhat Hanh's metaphor of the cloud, and, you know, the conditions are right and the cloud appears and then the conditions are different and the cloud turns into rain, I'm like, I don't really like to think of my self-consciousness and agency as being, if that's only there when the cloud is there and then it goes away, like there's some, it's a little snag there. That seems like that's not something that you just talk about, like manifesting and then not manifesting. There's more of a sense of, like he was saying, the coming and going, the birth and the death. Like it's very difficult not to think of those things as things that, you know, have a beginning and an endurance and an end. So anyway, to see those things as empty is quite a challenge. And I'm going to give you, let's see. So there's one, another image, a classic Buddhist image for trying to invite ourselves to explore the emptiness of self, which some of you may have heard before, and that's a very ancient scripture, not quite as far back as the Pali Canon, but it's the story of the questions of King Milinda, and a king is asking a sage, Nagasena, about you say the self is empty, but you call yourself Nagasena, and you know, he's arguing with that. And Nagasena says, well, you know, you came to this lecture in a chariot, correct? And the king goes, yes. He said, so what, you know, what is the chariot? And this is like a Socratic kind of dialogue. And he says, are the wheels the chariot? And the king goes, no. Is the axle the chariot? No. Is the, you know, the cart the chariot? Is the lead to the whatever animal was drawing it, is that the chariot? No. If you just took all those elements and you piled them up, would that be a chariot? No. And so then he says, Nagasena says, well, clearly you lied, because like, you didn't come here in a chariot. The chariot doesn't exist. And the king's like, well, you know, I mean, you put it together and it works like a chariot. And he says, exactly. I'm Nagasena. Like, I manifest as Nagasena, just like the chariot manifested and got you here. And yet there is nothing that you can point to say that is the chariot. So there's many, many, many different metaphors. And I love Thich Nhat Hanh's of trying to invite us to think about this. Think of ourselves as manifestations, temporary, changing, no-self manifestations. So, considering that teachings are, they're supposed to be helpful. Like you were saying, these are antidotes. If we're too attached to being, then we're asked to contemplate non-being. But non-being, we're also supposed to get attached to non-being either. So Thich Nhat Hanh had many different beautiful ways of saying, you know, this is like, it's the extinction of concepts, right? It's not about getting attached to one or the other. It's about recognizing they don't apply. Neither of the dualities apply. So I thought we'd get into breakouts for 10 minutes or so, and not everybody has to share if you don't want to, but wondering what teachings or experiences, Buddhist or not, have you found helpful in dealing with your own fear of death or non-being, whether it's, you know, whether it's been fear of your own death or, you know, fear of loss of others, or just kind of a more of a sense of more of a existential, perhaps, despair about just meaninglessness. Is it, you know, is it all a void after this? However you've experienced the kind of fear that Thich Nhat Hanh talked about as being, as long as we have this fear, our happiness can't be complete. So then what teachings have you encountered or experiences you've had that for a moment at least let you go, you know, it's okay, or gave you a little bit more sense of spaciousness or perspective around this great matter of life and death. So, I will invite you to rooms. going to even them out a little bit. All right. Hopefully you shared some good nuggets of wisdom. So sometimes the Buddhist teachings that are supposed to give us some solace, help us make sense of things, help us feel better, it's not immediately obvious why they should. You know, no self and emptiness. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, God loves you, and when you die, you're going to, you know, you won't actually die. You'll just go to a different place and you'll be reunited with all your loved ones. Like, that's reassuring, right? But it's like, well, actually yourself doesn't exist. You're just a manifestation. Why is that helpful? So, you know, this reminds me, of course, of which Thich Nhat Hanh even quotes or refers to, is our Heart Sutra. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, which is the wisdom that sees emptiness, the true prajna, true insight, is insight into emptiness, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. And with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So Thich Nhat Hanh talks about that cloud. When the cloud hasn't gotten attached to ideas of self and birth and death and coming and going, the cloud has no fear. So, emptiness has a negative overtone. There's other words to use, like boundlessness, which is one that I like. That the definitions that we make, the discriminations that we make, are arbitrary and mind-made, so that in reality there is no real boundary. So I kind of like that aspect of it, but there's still a meaning that is missed by that word. So perhaps we should just study shunyata and start using that term. But here's what Thich Nhat Hanh has to say. No self also means emptiness, a technical term in Buddhism that means the absence of a separate self. We are of the nature of no self, but that does not mean we are not here. It does not mean that nothing exists. A glass can be empty or full of tea. But in order to be either empty or full, the glass has to be there. So emptiness does not mean non-being. It does not mean being either. It transcends all concepts. If you touch deeply the nature of impermanence, no self, and interbeing, you touch the ultimate dimension, the nature of nirvana. So this is where that original Buddhist practice, they didn't talk so much about emptiness. They talked about the practice of not self. So those aspects of self that I was talking about earlier, it said if you cultivate the practice of thinking that is not self, that is not myself, then you are freed from attachment and dukkha. So, for example, like that sense of agency and the sense of self-consciousness that is so difficult for us to even see outside of, if we can work on recognizing those as also not self, then we taste some of this freedom from fear that Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about. So in what sense could your sense of agency is not self? your self-consciousness is not self. What does that really mean when we can perceive it that way? And he mentions in other places that, you know, just intellectually contemplating this, just intellectually even understanding it in a way, is one thing. But to actually perceive it is another. And that's what really frees us. Because intellectually, you know, it helps a little bit. But honestly, our fear is primal. Our fear is not going to be assuaged by just, you know, a couple ideas. So this is why we, he said something about exploring this in our meditation. I'm trying to figure out, okay. The not just intellectual understanding. Said all of us can understand impermanence with our intellect, but this is not yet true understanding. Our intellect alone will not lead us to freedom. It will not lead us to enlightenment. When we are solid and we concentrate, we can practice looking deeply. And when we look deeply and see the nature of impermanence, we can then be concentrated on this deep insight. So, well, they ended up with only 3 minutes left to talk about emptiness and take Q&A on that. but I'll just leave with he says something in here, if we can use impermanence as an object of our meditation. So I've frequently had people ask, you know, what does that mean? We're doing Shikantaza. Would you sit there and think about impermanence? What does it mean to use impermanence as an object of our meditation? And there certainly are forms of Buddhism where they do more systematic kinds of meditation. But for us, what that means is, I guess, outside of Zazen, in our reading, in our whatever form our practice takes, if we're talking to a teacher, if we're journaling, if we're something, we can make this question a focal point of our practice, such and try to really start embodying that question, so that when we sit, that question is part of who we are. So it's not that we're intellectually summoning the idea of impermanence and mulling it over. It's that we've awakened the question of impermanence in ourselves. We've brought it alive in our lives. However we've managed to do that. And then it is just there. It's part of our sitting. And then that's where, like as we'd say, we recite something by Hong Zhu, who says, "Bright clarity appears of itself." So that when we're sitting with these issues, there's just insight can occur simply because we are still and open and observant. And then there are certain moments, you know, and it happens differently for different people, but and usually when you describe them to other people, your moment of insight where you really saw how, you know, even your consciousness is impermanent, even your consciousness is not self, or however, you know, usually you can't describe them. When you describe them to somebody else, you'll just be like, yeah, I was watching, you know, drinking some tea, and then I was watching the steam come off the tea, and I realized, like, I am I'm no different than the steam. You know, to me, like, it'd be kind of a crazy sounding observation, but for other people who've had similar experiences, will go like, yeah, I know what you mean. Because, you know, in a way we taste a similar thing, even if it manifests in different ways. So it's 9 o'clock. I guess I'll leave it at that. We have plenty to talk about next time. I'm sure there's going to be more on emptiness and more on not self. And if you had any questions this time that we didn't get to, then maybe you want to jot them down and we can bring them up next week. So thank you all. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Jill. Meow.